Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's show, we have numero uno, the king himself, Michael Viljanen of Chapter One by Michael Viljanen, coming in, joining us today. Waiting to get him for a while. Looking forward to that, Gareth.
Yeah, I suppose it's somebody whose career that we've all looked upon from outside. And if you're not really heavily involved in the food world, if you're somebody that just likes cooking and or you like eating food, if you haven't been to Chapter One, I would say save up and go and eat there, because it's really on the world stage. Like, it's arguably the best restaurant or one of the best restaurants in Ireland. But if you have any interest in knowing what really good food is like, go there. So
yeah,
you know, it's not cheap. It's not a cheap place.
We're gonna get into it. I mean, he's come from Finland into the tannery, Cregan's Castle, the greenhouse.
Got he's Irish now.
Yeah, he's Irish now. Yeah, he's here in the guts of 30 years, I'd say, now at this stage. So yeah, that'll be interesting. I mean, obviously lots of guys have name checked him as being the GOAT. So and it'll be good to get going. We'll have our usual ingredient, fresh ingredient of the week, and food at goloudnow.com for all your foodie questions. And we've a decent wee batch in here, and we're going to get to them. So stay on board. All right, Gareth, it's ingredient of the week time. What are you going with, brother?
So I'm going to go with, it's a little bit of a broad stroke, I'm kind of cheating, it's like I done last week with the herbs, it's spices. And it's something that I use much more than I thought I did in my home cookery. And we've had a couple of messages from a few different people about their enjoying kind of getting behind the cupboards and behind the kitchens of what professional chefs do at home. And I suppose I bought a little tiffin box a few years ago.
Yeah.
And I use it all the time.
Is it still in the box?
It's still in the box, yeah, exactly. But it's smoked paprika, cumin, coriander, cayenne, turmeric, chili powder and curry powder. That's the seven spices that are in there. And I remember I was at a demo out in the Roos a few years ago with Aaron.
From Ananda.
From the
Green Saffron.
Green Saffron. I couldn't think of the name of the spice company. And I remember him telling me about, you know, I was at, like, when you open his spices, like, they nearly take the head off you. They're not fragrant. And I was asking him what that was about. And he was like, try and buy your spices somewhere where that sells spices.
Yeah.
And I remember just that being a
that they're always moving.
They're moving.
Yeah.
So now I buy my spices in there's an Indian or an Asian shop in Swords. And whenever I buy spices, that's where I go, because they're moving through there.
Yeah.
And I don't buy a kilo at a time. I'll only buy like 100.
Because these dried spices, in case you're not familiar, listeners, they
lose their life.
Rancid, they lose their life. And that's why you'll always, and I'm sure you'll get to it as well, you always got to nearly dry roast them in a pan before using them. You sort of rejuvenate them. It's like a nut.
Heat basically releases the natural oils that are in the spice. So, and even like if you're grinding them yourself, even better again. Like, and I think you done a recipe a few weeks ago where we spoke about the mortar and pestle. So even if it's a peppercorn or it's, you know, a clove or whatever it is, if you just warm it and toast it slightly in a pan. This morning I was doing a bit of batch cooking, so and I made like a chicken curry, I made some chili, I made some ribs at the weekend, and I just liked a little bit of spice just brings everything to life. And then the biggest trick you'll use whenever you're spicing anything, you have to really think about acidity. So whether it's a bit of lime juice or a bit of lemon juice, that's what's going to really brighten those things up for you.
Yeah.
Obviously salt. So yeah, I went with spices this week. So
lovely.
So Gary, what's your ingredient this week?
I'm going to go with a crowd favourite and say chicken.
Oh, yeah.
Very versatile. Probably.
Are you a corn-fed man or are you?
No. I tell you, I actually hate
corn-fed chicken.
No, I like corn-fed chicken. I just hate the terminology.
Yeah.
I also hate the yellowness of the corn-fed chicken. I think they douse it in a bath of turmeric or something. I'm like, does all chicken...
Wouldn't be the corn,
would it? Does all chicken not eat corn? Like, are these ones sort of licking something else off the grass as well?
Chicken,
yeah. Do you know what I mean? I would say Would you think it's above beef as the number one protein in the country? Probably in the sense that more people would buy chicken, maybe, but maybe not out of preference. But I'd say it's a very...
I think it has to be the most consumed.
It has to be the most consumed, yeah.
If it's not, it's...
Yeah, and obviously there's always the argument, Gareth, you know, about the price. You know, anybody will tell you, like, a good organic chicken, not everyone could spend it. But look, supermarkets, you're probably going to top out around 12, 13 quid. We get you a really, really good one. Organic or free range or free to roam birds, then, or maybe a wee bit more. But look, they're up on, the other side about it is they're up on 2,200 grams at that weight. So you got to think about the weight as well. Never just look at the price of the chicken. You know, oh yeah, it was 18 quid, but was it a 1,400 gram chicken or a 1500 gram chicken? There's a massive difference in that to a 2200 gram chicken, you know. So a 2200 gram chicken is quite a huge bird, and really that's a roasting bird. Another thing I'll tell you about chicken is the flavor. The bigger the chicken, the more flavor it has, generally speaking. It's been worked more and rolled about more. I just find that I also find chicken not as nice as it used to be when I was a kid.
Is that a romantic idea, I wonder?
No, that's a fact.
I can't remember chickens being more tasty when I was younger.
You were too busy eating coddle up here, you see.
Yeah, maybe.
When the rest of us sophisticated cats in Donegal were tearing into...
Yeah, well, you know, we'd have cock a van on a Sunday and...
Imagine coming home from mass. What's for dinner, old boy? Cock a van. Get up by that. Cock a fucking van. Would you go away? I tell you what, though. Jeez, I make a nice cock.
Oh, well, I'm sure.
I know. Get my wee cipollini onions in there, or pearl onions, whatever you're into, Cynthia.
Are you a leg or a breast man, or do you like a bit of...
Everything, yeah. It all depends. It all depends on what sort of dish I'm cooking, you know. I do this beautiful jambalaya with the thighs, the drum... leg, the drums and the thighs. I sort of, you know, really season them well, like a few hours before anything. Many times there's a bone in the chicken, you got to get seasoning in there early and let it sit, not in a marinade, but in an actual seasoning, salt it, let it dry, rub the salt into the skin as well, a good 2 hours before you want to cook it. The meat starts seeping in that saltiness and it's getting its way in. Obviously, anybody that's a pro when you're roasting chicken, anything with a bone really should be brined. Now, a brine solution is like a salt, sugar, spice, water solution that's brought up to the boil. It's left to cool, and there's a ratio there. You can Google. You can Google all the different you know, recipes on there, whatever. But you know, you can put in a few cinnamon sticks, whole peppercorns, star anise, whatever it is that you're into, you know, and then you put your chicken into that liquid solution overnight, and the bird soaks it all in. You know, it's the same with a rack of pork and stuff like that. It's a bit of a, you know, process, but if you've got a big enough area or a fridge or a way, you can do it. A chance at some time, you know. Probably the nicest way of doing it, though, is buttermilk. I think if you've never had chicken that's been seasoned and then sat in a marinade or a brine solution of buttermilk or natural yogurt, you haven't lived. It just does something absolutely magical to the bird, Gareth. You know what I mean? Like, it really, really, really does. I have one that I just do, like, this sort of southern fried chicken again.
When you worked in the States, that must have been all around you, like that kind of, that buttermilk,
yeah,
using that as a major ingredient.
Yeah.
Where in our world in Ireland, like, buttermilk, the obvious thing to talk about was obviously
soda bread. Yeah. It's for bread, yeah. But, you know,
I'm a huge fan of chicken wings.
Oh.
Do you like the flat ones with the two little bones or the doodle?
I'm a flatty.
Really?
Yeah, flatty all the way. Well, I love salting them anyway, say it's the wings, right? I salt them about an hour or two before I want them. And that drags out a wee bit of moisture as well. So then when they're nice and moist from the salt, as well as seasoned, I have a seasoned potato starch or corn flour, but ideally a potato starch that I have smoked paprika in, a little bit of fine sea salt and white pepper. And then I toss it really excessively in the potato starch and then into either deep fat fryer, or I have this Poxy air fryer. It's one of those ones that kind of moves around the base, one of the first generation air fryers. But it is amazing for wings because it's heating the top and it's heating at the bottom and it's being rolled 45 minutes, and a little bit of cracked, I'm not mad about too much heat, but the little chili flakes that you buy as well, put them in there. And once that starts, peel a few carrots, peel a few stalks of celery, cut them up into battens, into a container, clean them, and then cover them with cold water and a good two or three shovelfuls of ice. It really, really adds crispness to the carrot and the celery. So like they snap like a twig in your mouth, and the crunch just goes crazy. So the ice cold water, they absorb it. It's beautiful. And then we've said it before again, it'll be all in Gareth's Instagram and mine.
The key is, I think, a little bit of bacon powder in with that seasoning.
Oh, yeah.
And have you ever tried that? You put bacon, have you ever
tried it? Does that make them spongy?
No, it makes them go super crispy. Honestly, the next time you're doing it, you're that exact
no bother.
Throw in a little bit of bacon.
No, I like your recipes, Gaz. You never let me down. But look, chicken's my ingredient of the week.
Good one.
Absolutely love it. So versatile. You can do so much with it. And buy Irish.
The last little trick I'll just give you with chicken. If you're roasting your chicken, learn how to take out the wishbone.
Yeah.
It takes no time at all once you learn how to do it, but it'll actually get the whole breast off the board, because otherwise your knife hits it when you're on your way.
Your knife hits it, yes.
Just Google it. How do you take a wishbone out of chicken? And there wouldn't be a professional chef on earth that wouldn't take a wishbone out before they roast it. So that's one little chef trick that will really get more meat off the bone.
You lose about 3/4 of an inch at either side because the knife comes down the backbone, the breastbone. It hits the wishbone. So all the meat that's tucked in behind both sides, you can't get the knife at it. That's the chef's. I'm having to say that's the wee bit we eat. It's like the oyster, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so you probably heard Gareth and I talking about this legend plenty over season one and over the last couple of weeks as well. Easily, I would say, I think we sort of call him a unique individual in the sense that he's got his own league table, and then there's the rest of us Muppets. Michael Villanen, chef patron of Chapter One in Dublin. Easily the best chef I've ever stood beside in a kitchen. I never felt so inadequate in all my 30 years in a kitchen than the few days I spent cooking with you. Very much welcome to Dishing It Out.
Thanks very much.
Delighted. How's the form? Over.
Good form. Can't complain.
I was going to say, we got you out of the kitchen for, you got yourself a day off, but you're actually not off. You've just got a little private gig going on. You bounced out, thankfully, for a couple of an hour or so to spend a bit of time with today. So greatly appreciate it, Mike.
Delighted to be over.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, that was big news. We'll probably go right back to the beginning first. And I know everybody talks about you coming to Ireland first. I'm probably one of very few that knows that you didn't go straight to Paul Flynn's, dirty hound dog.
Not at all.
And you were the second best chef that ever worked in the Hudson Bay Hotel, as far as
Third best.
Well, I presume it was a woman that brought you to Athlone, was it?
No, just
you stuck a finger in the map and landed in the middle?
It was a long story. I was back from England, and I was in a local back home on the west coast of Finland, Irish bar. And the guy beside me was from Ireland, from Athlone. And his mom was the restaurant manager in Hudson Bay at the time. And he said, you should go over. This was 99, 2000 maybe.
Yeah.
And you should go over there. And I said, maybe. 4 days later, I was in a plane coming over for a year. And that's 24 years later.
Where were you in London?
I was in England. I was Northern England, in Newcastle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cooking.
Yeah. I was sent from college over there. Then I stayed and they came back down again.
And you were born in Sweden, actually, which I never knew until producer Ed produced the goods.
Yeah.
Did some scouting and came up with that. But what, you must have moved to Finland quite early then?
I was three, I think.
Because that's what I've always just presumed. But anyway, probably the biggest move as far as Ireland was concerned then was, which, again, another chef that I hold in great regard, as does Gareth, was Paul Flynn. You went to the tannery then, was it?
Oh, yeah, I was there with Paul. It was a great year. Yeah, Paul is an amazing guy. I don't think I've never come across anybody who has as good of a palate. And he'd be the first one to tell you that he's no technical miracle.
Yeah.
But man, can he eat. He knows what's good, you know. And you learn so much out of it. And it was a different story, but it was big menus back in, that's nearly 20 years ago now. So, like, you'd be in a corner in the ladder with a 4-burner electric ring and you have 8 starters, 4 of them hot.
and you learned the pants.
And it was busy. I remember summer, you'd do Sunday lunch, you'd do 110, dinner after 120. And you learn to run.
I always think of the old post when you hear that, you know, like I worked there for the calendar year 2007 as well. Fucking six ring burner, only two of them fucking worked. Yeah. You had to have a tactical master plan get into service on a Saturday night, about 150, 160 for lunch on a Sunday. But it's amazing how you can grow resolve and you adapt and you just get on with it. And it nearly becomes part of the fuck you kitchen. Like, I'll get through service, I'll be fine.
And it's always the run of it. Who does it quickest? Who does everything? I don't have quite the energy levels left anymore to do that anymore. But
I know you'd think that too. You'd be like, Jesus, why did we not just say fix the cooker?
or how would you get through it anymore? And like, if you'd be asking lads now to do 8 starters off the one stove, that day's gone, you know? But you learn a lot.
Yes, because as you say there with Paul, God, you know, that's the type of place I'd love to see get a star. It's almost like chapter one initially getting a star, you know, it's consistency over... Like,
and I think all you get, one thing I've realised, some of the best meals I've had, they're not Instagram food, they're not food. I think it's a lot comes down to it's time and place, who you're with, where you are, whatever it is. But also the fact that if you go to, say, you go to rural France, probably spend a mortgage eating out in France over my lifetime or whatever. And some of the old school 2 and 3 stars, what you eat there, they're not there for Instagram. But I tell you what, it's some of the best meals I've ever had. It's all just flavour of produce. And they don't care what it looks like. You know what I mean? In a sense, of course, it's tidy enough. It's not thrown together. But at the same time, the emphasis is never to make something look amazing first. Flavour is there always first.
How often do you get across to France?
Not as often as I'd like anymore, just too busy. But I years gone, I would have been there 5, 6, 7 times a year to go and eat.
Would you put France over any other country, over London or over New York, as far as, like, who's first to the plate with the new stuff?
I think France is funny. I think you eat in... lower end, really, really, really well. Then you have a lot of rubbish in the middle. Mm. And then you have to pay serious money to eat again well. And that's the problem with France. You go, and I think for the same money, you eat a lot better in rural France than you do, for example, in Paris. Paris has a handful of amazing places which blow you away. And then you go to countryside in France and...
I think the differentiator in France a lot of the time is the front of house experience as opposed to just the food.
But for them, it's a career. And I think you need to know what you're dealing with as well. And same time, say, you look at restaurants like that, you go somewhere like Maison Gérard. It's a complete different experience compared to going to Paris. You go to Aleno or you go to any of those places out there, Ducasse in Paris, whatever, or Canière, whatever. They're complete different worlds. I think you need to know what you walk into and what you're going to eat. And you manage your expectations differently.
Yeah.
And you go to the countryside, you know the produce is just down from the garden. This guy's growing his apples. This guy's growing... Everything is done there. So you need to... In its own category, essentially, you know what you walk into.
Yeah,
and I think then you do okay, and I think you kind of need to know where to eat in France. So France is not that golden point anymore. I'd say middle market, you eat a lot better. The best middle market, by far, is America. They do that middle market food, the best without a doubt.
America has also
what's middle market? What tell us
like upper middle market, like that. I'm not talking about start restaurants. I'm talking about really good eating. Even the early level start restaurants. Like one of my favorite restaurants is Coat. In New York is a Korean grill. I've been there 4 or 5 times and it is
delicious, brilliant.
You go in there, massive cocktail bar, hanging rooms downstairs, the place is heaving, they do 300 covers a night and it's just delicious stuff, you know? Mm. They do that really well, that market, and it's fun and it's well, busy and buzzing.
America brings a lot of fun to everything, sports, dining. They're thinking about the crowd interaction all the time, you know, everything's an experience.
Entertainment, even part of it.
Entertainment.
It's very considered in that matter. But I also think that people have kind of lost their way sometimes thinking about restaurants. To me, if you look at restaurants, let it be top end, middle market, low end, whatever it is, restaurants are meant to be about the punter. It's meant to be about having fun, being looked after, and kicking back, having 2 glasses of wine. I'm not a big fan anymore of restaurants where there's this hushed silence and you need to sit certain way or look certain way or wear this or wear that. I don't care what you wear, shorts, swimming goggles, as long as you behave and you pay your bills. That's what restaurants are about. They're meant to be somewhere where you go with your mates and your family or whatever.
No ambience in a restaurant. I remember a few years ago, there was a castle in Galway that you might know the name of it now because Angelica Houston owned it or her daddy owned it. There was a Japanese head chef. He cooked in Galway for a long time. He got well known.
It was a house outside Galway City.
Near Crockwell, yeah.
Something house.
Yeah, and anyway, I went there for a dinner one night. It only sat about 12 or 14 people. I cannot begin to tell you how uncomfortable an experience it was, right? And the food would blow your mind. And I remember just being there and said, Jesus, if they put on ambient music,
okay,
you know, it would be amazing.
One restaurant that I'll never ever forget how they make you feel. I won't name the restaurant. I was in Scotland and I sat down for a meal and I was wearing jeans and a shirt.
Mm.
Everybody else around was in suits or whatever.
And give you a jacket, did they?
No, not at all. There's a good story about that, how to do that with class. I'll tell you after. Yeah. We sat down and whatever, menus are given. Sommelier comes by and says, I assume you won't be having wine then.
Oh.
And I kind of looked at him and said, you know what? Fuck you.
Yeah.
But this is years ago, so I had no money. What I thought then was expensive bottle. I ordered that and then regretted heavily leaving after.
I'm a big baller. Yeah, 60 euro.
Exactly, at the time. That's what restaurants are not about, you know.
Oh yeah.
But you can do those things with class as well.
Of course.
I'll never forget sitting in courtyard in Le Cinq, and first time being in there and kind of nervous looking around the place like a palace or whatever. I'm in a courtyard having a drink and smoking a cigarette and whatever, and you could see to the restaurant from the courtyard. And I had no sports jacket. I had slacks on and I had a shirt on and whatever and a winter coat over it. But obviously you could see them, they're looking at the courtyard or whatever. We go back into the hotel, walk into the dining room. Without a word, there's a lady with a jacket ready to go like that.
For you?
Yeah. And I literally just slid into it and there was no word said. Yeah. And I just thought, that's class, without making you feel uncomfortable. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. How important, there's a lot of chefs listening to this, so how important is going to eat in other restaurants, do you think, for development?
Very, very. I think if you go years back and you are obviously limited what you can do and can't do and whatever, I think I ate too much. Like, I pushed the budgets that, will I be able to do a rent now? But I think that's the only way you learn. Obviously, you work in good places, you learn, but you need to eat and see. And I think the key is that you need to eat in better restaurants than you're in. If you're constantly eating in a better restaurant, if there's a one thing you get out of it, it's been worth it. That could be a simple thing. That could be a door handle. That could be how they lay the glasses down. That could be how they speak to you. That could be mostly what's on the plate. And you don't have to like everything. But I think if you learn even a one thing, it's been worth it. It's like years ago, you're buying cookbooks. And if there's a one thing in that book that something clicks and you see, wow, that's really clever, it's been worth it. You know,
I kind of feel the food world has changed. Like, I don't think it's as closed door as it once was.
It's a lot easier now. You can go
to
the internet.
If you ask another chef or another chef asks you for something, whether it's a recipe or it's a supplier.
The whole culture has changed on that.
But, you know, like, if you think back 20 years ago, no one told anybody anything.
Yeah. Well, you know, I would put Michael up there at somebody as well that helped that because...
Yeah, for sure.
You know, you would have had obviously the old school boys, but like the likes of Ross, Derry, Kevin Thornton, Paul Flynn, they were all over and they're all from that generation before us. Like, but when we started hanging out with them or started kind of going to the odd event and they were all kind of cool, I think then that started sending, there probably was a wee ring of that era as well that maybe thought that they were as good as them, but those boys were lovely. But you know, and that'll take us up to your time in Craigan's Castle, because like I remember going down there with Frankie Fish for dinner with you, and you know, seeing a lot of things for the first time. And James, my owner in Viewmount, that Michael and Gareth, you have both met James. James used to eat out a lot, and he was always really honest with me, and I liked that. You know what I mean? The only place he ever went, and he came back, and he said to me, he just says, you're going to have to go. He says, it's definitely, he loved me, and he loved what we were doing in Viewmount, but he was like, going, this is just another level. It goes, it's so guy
was,
so innovative.
Was that your first head chef shop?
And
yeah. Well, I had one before years gone back home. It's funny. I was 22 at the time. I went home back in the middle of it for a year or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was there for a job and I got a head chef job. And he still says today that at least you got to learn on my money.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the man in must be more than 15 years. He's actually booked into a restaurant.
Who's that?
My old boss from Finland.
Well,
and I haven't seen him for 15 years and I have a lot of time for him. He's actually booked in. His daughter booked them in for dinner. They actually in 2 weeks' time for dinner in a restaurant.
Oh, you must be looking forward to booking
for him. I really am. And it's great to see them. I haven't seen them in a long time. They were very good to me at the time. They never gave out of cheapies. Cheapies were really poor. Obviously, you don't know how to manage anything.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've learned since, but but he always said, listen, at least you got to learn on my money.
And
I have a lot of respect.
You'll
get
to return that favour now. You know, my whole point there being was like when I asked Michael in the next day or even that night, you know, how did you make that and how did you make that? It was like he lit up and you had a notebook out and you were writing stuff down. But the next day, me and Frankie were driving up and I was like going, I can't believe he didn't just tell me to fuck off. It goes like he actually showed me, he brought me in. Do you know, at that stage it was like jellifying liquids and powder.
Yeah.
It was all starting to kind of come in and it was just a game changer. And then that brought another couple of learnings for me back to the crew there.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Giving you a helping hand with your food frustrations.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
So, not getting a star in Craigan's, how did that happen? Like, there must be...
I was too busy.
I
look at it now. Yeah.
Jesus, I don't know.
The food was so busy. Some of the plates had three dinners on them.
Yeah.
You know, I only get it now afterwards.
Three little dinners, I'd say.
Listen, you can say whatever about Michelin. Like it, don't like it, different, indifferent, whatever. But personally, I can say how things have gone is... they kind of been right.
And
you, at the time, you don't want to accept it. You know?
Yeah.
You're arrogant. You're young. You think you know better.
And then when you work on so long and so... You know, sometimes you falsely think you're owed something, don't you?
Yeah. And that sense of entitlement or ownership for something what you haven't earned is wrong. But I think it's in everyone when they're young. And you're going to mellow out and start looking at things differently. It was too busy. Listen, it was... probably ahead of his time for Clare at the time.
And
that, but I think it was just...
Was that why you left there, though, or was it just life circumstance that you wanted
it was more so the thing... I remember at the time, I was there for 4.5 years, I was just, okay, I was always thinking, will I go to Dublin, will I not go to Dublin, whatever, and then it just came up. I said, okay, I might as well do that then and try it. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And I'll never forget that first day. I tell you now, when I came to Dublin, we did the first soft opening on Dawson Street at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember climbing up to Stephen's Green car park into my car and banging my head against the wheel and thinking, what have I done? It's the biggest mistake of my life.
Boy, what was the reason?
It was just horrendous. The first soft opening life was just so bad. I was, you know, I always...
Was it that bad?
It was just in my head. Everything, nothing was right. And I was thinking, I've really fucked up now. That's it. Like, this is my biggest mistake ever. And I sat there, it was silence. I always say to the guys, I know what kind of night I've had when I drive home. If I'm driving the limit, windows are closed and radio is off, it's been a really bad night, you know? And when the window is down and there's tunes on, I'm going home. And it was definitely one of those that it was silent in the car alone going home. I listened. And then we came back the next day and it was one of the best nights I've ever had.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those that you kind of have to pick yourself up.
You have to sleep on a bad service, don't you?
But you have to have them as well.
Oh, yeah.
Listen, of course you do. And anybody who thinks that it happens.
What is the ambition for Chapter 1 then?
I don't know if there's any ambition. You do it for yourself now. I honestly, don't look at it that way. I look at it in a way that...
Now, just for our listeners, we're a week away from the Michelin Guide coming out, but by the time you hear this, the guide will have been out. It's the 5th or 6th of February in Manchester, which is next Monday or Tuesday, Michael, right?
Monday.
It's next Monday in Manchester, Midlands Hotel. Hopefully Alex Reid's getting a few because I think he's the best chef.
Cool stuff, man.
Yeah, and so if we were to ring you now, right now, as in when people are listening to this, have you got 3 stars, do you think?
I honestly, listen.
Or are you back?
There's nothing...
Money messing.
I'm predictable as them, you know.
We're a week out now, so you don't know.
Honestly, I don't know. I've never known. People think you know in advance.
Is there a chance?
You don't... Listen, there's a chance of anything, I guess. But I honestly, I don't know. And older you get, more you realise, listen, they operate... The way they operate, I don't know. What there's no, yeah. There
are
is
you
logic.
Still,
I
just don't every know year, logic. But like at some decisions that Michelin make, because sometimes I do kind of go, yeah, I never thought they were a second, or that was a fourth, yeah, or they lost one, or but me.
But isn't it amazing, like that? All them years that the disappointment of not getting the one in Craigan's, and now it's the fact that the conversation now is only he's going to be the first 3-star that Ireland ever had.
But the thing is that I don't look at it that way at all. I think. If you look after your restaurant, you do what you think is right, if your customers are happy, there's a high likelihood that Michelin will be happy as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's not something that if you... It's a funny question, people ask, oh, are you aiming for a star? Are you aiming for 2 stars? I think more you aim for that, that's
you're
being more wrong
open.
Because yeah. You're forcing something. I think it needs to come organic and natural, whatever yeah. It is. And I think when you relax... I remember the monkey off my back when the first one came in Greenhouse. I think I haven't felt so relaxed, whereas you think that the opposite, you're under pressure. Mm. It was kind of something that I needed to get out of my system.
Yeah,
and I'm so long trying to crunt it and whatever. When it comes, then it's kind of where, okay, now I'm going to do what I want to do. And that's when you start to do it.
Because the key is like, I mean, it's just an unbelievable accomplishment. One. Two is
But one of the things that always strikes me about you, Mick, from somebody that looks, you seem to have this drive and energy that doesn't seem to distinguish or fall off in any way. Now you might disagree with that, but from where I'm sitting, I'd be like everything that you do was from an aesthetics point of view looks incredible. I've never spoken to anybody that's eaten in any of restaurants and said they didn't enjoy themselves. So, and that would be the biggest compliment I could pay a chef.
No, like I said, that's the biggest compliment. You see returning customers, you have regulars,
yeah.
Restaurant is busy. Yeah. I think that's the key at the end of the
day. Where is that drive and passion if it's not for...
Because it's a fear of failure. I think it's the biggest motivator is fear of failure. You know, it's not an option. You need to get up every day. You need to keep going, and failure can't be an option because you can't live like that. I think you should always try to look at things how you can improve things, and by nature they come like that.
You had to sacrifice a home life for this life?
Yeah, of course. Everybody in this industry, you know, anybody who does this seriously or takes it, it's never going to be very sociable hours or whatever. It's a lot better now than it was years ago, you know, and the days of doing 5 doubles, they're gone now, you know what I mean? In that sense, like, restaurants don't tend to open like that anymore either. Of course, there's a price for everything. It's like any profession. You ask a doctor who actually has an important job, unlike ours. We are essentially glorified dinner ladies.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing about that is that you look at some new doctor going in there doing 24, 36 hour shifts.
Yeah, yeah.
And those are people's lives. Yeah. They're the real job. They sacrifice a lot to get where they want
to be.
How
many kids have you, Mick?
4.
What are the ages are they now?
My oldest is 22.
Oh, wow.
17, 12 and 10.
Wow.
Yeah, my oldest is working in reception.
I was going to say, you got a couple
she's
of...
She's in there, and the young lad's washing pots.
Is he?
Yeah.
And anyone talking about cooking, or...?
I don't know. I think I'd prefer them not to. Do something else.
But if that's what they want,
I wouldn't say no if that's what they want to do, but you know yourself that in that
funny,
job...
I would want them to do anything other than... I just wouldn't want them to have to work as hard.
Yeah, exactly. And how many of those who enter that profession are actually going to be having a normality of life and successful, and it's minimal. But then, same time, you can't tell them no. If they want to enter it, absolutely.
Can you imagine someone telling you that your life wouldn't be around food?
Not now. Yeah. No, I think everything is, it's been just that. I'm useless at most things. I couldn't put IKEA flat back together.
I don't feel so bad.
Honestly, it's the only thing I'm semi-decent at. And like, it's been that since I was 14. I started at 14 in a Botwash in the hotel. Yeah. Then after that, you go into the nightclub of the hotel collecting glasses from tables till 4 a.m. Then you were the lucky boy who got a beer at the end of it, and that just sucks you in. And that's the problem with it. It's the nice parts of it what sucks you sometimes into those things.
But also, I think when you speak to people that really life is their, or food is their life. And I mean, obviously, I know loads of chefs, and the ones that have success are the ones that really buy into it. But your family has to buy into it, and you know, but you get so much joy from it. And I know there's hours involved.
And I think, I always say that somebody says, are you passionate about it? I think passionate is something, if you're collecting stamps or coins or something, you're obsessed. And it's an obsession what doesn't last. You know what I mean? You just go, and you're always looking at things, improving things or whatever. But at the same time, you have to remember as well, you're asking what drives you. Is that, like somebody a lot smarter than me said before, that like success is never owned, it's rented, and rent is due every day. And if you don't mind it all the time, what are you going to do? And especially, like I said, it's a business at first and foremost. It's like anything. It's like a pharmacist. It's like a shop. It's like a restaurant. It's a business. So if you don't have the business, you don't have the employees, you don't pay wages, you don't pay bills. And so you have to mind that part of it. And that what makes you look is, what makes this business successful? How do I look after people better? How do I give them what I want? But same time, doing your own vision on those things. Because your vision could be very different to what a punter wants. And then you're going to have to melt the two of them together.
That's true.
And that's where it comes very difficult. I think you need to look at it from so many angles. And you only learn that as you get older.
True. Well, look, we always ask our guests to bring in a cookbook to round things off. What have you gone with, Michael?
I have a 20-odd-year-old book. It used to be a two-star restaurant years ago in Helsinki called Chez Dominique. And you can see how battered the thing is.
I was going to say, it's well used.
And it's battered.
Where was it in Helsinki?
Yeah. And I remember being as a kid and looking at those places and thinking, that's moon food. Like, what is that?
Is it still open?
No. It's gone. It's gone. Long gone. And it was in top 50 in the world list or whatever. But you look at that book and bear in mind, it's 24, 23 years old. And look at the food in there. How ahead of its time it was. It was incredible. It's unreal, eh? Like someone that would be nearly still relevant at times.
Yeah, yeah. Almost looks even a little crap.
Yeah,
I did.
Do you know this chef? I don't personally know him. I know him, but I remember always looking at those places, and they were like, you'd be in Jupiter somewhere out there.
Yeah. It is actually very modern. That's mad.
Yeah, and it's 20 odd years ago, it was so ahead of its time.
And is that one that you know?
Yeah, one does inspire you.
Inspired and tweaking, because that's really what a cookbook does.
You
what
just
a recipe
brought this
does.
In, so we couldn't steal the recipes.
Exactly. No, but it's funny. Like it's like everything in life. You look at those people and all those big names when you're growing up and you're learning and whatever, and they look like they're like in a different planet. They're like movie stars nearly. Do you know?
You a book in the making?
I've had a book in the making for the last year and a half. I'm a bit slow finishing it up. It's kind of 60-70% done, but
it is a pain in the hole.
Absolute nightmare. It is, yeah. And I don't know when it will eventually.
I've had to do a book, and it says, look, there's just easier ways to make money. You're grand.
And it's not even about money. Halfway through, I said, if I do one, I'll never do another one again. They're absolute pain. You'd want to dedicate so much time for it, and you're trying to go and find gaps in your
usually
year.
Usually, when they give you a deal, though, they sign you up to two or three.
not lucky enough. No, it's just a one. But is it
a Michael Villanen book or a chapter one or a bit of both?
It's kind of a bit of a mixed bag, and it will be kind of. It has other stuff. It's half coffee table book, half stuff of what we eat and staff foods and what the guys cook at home, and
lovely.
It's going to be a mixed bag. What the girls and lads what they cook on their days off, and it's going to have bits and pieces like that.
Brilliant.
You know?
Well, look, that wraps us up. It's just been brilliant. We've been trying to get you in for a while. Obviously, where you're busy or at home on the rare Mondays that you're off, but Gareth and I certainly appreciate you taking time to pop into his the day, Michael. Wishing you all the best of luck next week. By the time everyone's listening to this, first and foremost, you hold on to the two you have. But I don't say too many prayers, but I always say a prayer for the few boys that I really like whenever these things, when these things come around. If you get a third one, mate, with, I can tell you now categorically, I for one would be over the moon for you, man. Nobody
richly deserved.
Nobody would deserve it more. Thank you.
Pleasure. Listen, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so this week we've got our culinary conundrums. Ed, what have we got?
I've just come up with a name for myself while I was listening to you there. Ed Chef.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Is that, can we? All right.
Yeah, yeah. Move, yes, Chef.
Tough crowd. Hi, lads. A few of us neighbours have been running a come dine with me type competition for the last few years. And while it's always good fun, it's been getting quite competitive recently.
Of course it is.
It's my turn to host next month, and I want to go all out. I have a funny feeling why it's getting competitive. I think we have our culprit. I really want to wow them with swordfish for the mains, but I need help on deciding what sauce to go with it, and what also, what would you recommend for the wine pairing? Many thanks, and absolutely love the podcast. Podcast Deirdre in Killarney.
An unusual choice of fish to cook for a crowd, but maybe... maybe it's something that she likes to do. So the only bit of advice I'd give you with swordfish is just make sure that it's nice and fresh, because swordfish, as it, some, you can age swordfish like tuna. It is a type of thing you can hang and age, but generally in the fishmongers, they don't do that. So just make sure that you're into the fishmonger and you're getting it really fresh. And I think, me personally, if I'm having swordfish, I'm definitely going down the road of like olive oil and vinegar rather than a cream sauce, because it needs to be cut. It needs acidity. You know those little jars of peeled peppers? They make brilliant little dressings. So you just finely chop them, maybe with some capers, a little bit of vinegar, some olive oil and some fresh herbs. Would be delicious. And then, that's the road I'd go after if I was cooking swordfish for somebody. Gary, what do you reckon?
Yeah, so first and foremost, I think it's a shocking choice of ingredient to go with for a...
Why is that?
I just think, first and foremost, crowd pleaser, I would avoid fish. And if I am going to do fish, I would go with something that people are familiar with.
And maybe, she's been doing it for a while.
But look, they probably know the group, and if they're into their food, they're probably fine. Very difficult to find it fresh. It probably will come in frozen, you know what I mean? Like, it's just not something that's caught off the coast of Ireland. So generally, it's going to come flash frozen. But let's just say you're using that. Put it into, like, get it seasoned. They come quite thick. It is, though, as far as fish is concerned, it's quite a meaty fish, yeah, in a sense. It's like tuna, not as fishy as tuna, though. So it's, you know, for somebody that's maybe not mad about fish, it's probably a good one in that sense. You know what I mean? Takes really well to being barbecued, right? Now, as far as a sauce is concerned, I'm going to give you one, but it's more a salsa than a sauce, all right? So take one really good pineapple, top and tail it, peel it, cut it in half. I'm going to get you to reserve one half. I'm going to get you to dice it up into a brunoise, which is a really small, delicate, neat dice. Set that aside. For the other half, you're going to use a food processor, cut it up into chunks, put it into a food processor with maybe like the tip of a teaspoon of flaked chilies, the juice of two limes, the juice of half a lemon, salt, white pepper, and then turn it on and put in about 50 mils of white wine vinegar. And while that's whizzing away, creating now like a pineapple-y vinegar solution, put in a teaspoon of honey, a teaspoon of mustard, and now you want to get about 120 or 130 mils of vegetable oil and slowly start pouring it in. It's going to emulsify, okay? Lift it out. Taste it, adjust the seasoning. You might need a little bit of sort of maybe more lemon juice or lime juice, salt, pepper. Now chop in one full handful, like one full pot of fresh coriander, and get about a half a bunch of scallions, chiffon at it, so slice it really thin on the bias, chop it all up, put all that in there. And now what you want to do is you want to feed that pineapple solution into the diced pineapple that you came. So you're not going to use all of this pineapple sort of sauce or emulsion or whatever, but feed that in and then keep folding it so that you have a lovely sort of thick pineapple salsa. And then add in about one or two shots of a tequila that you really like, okay? And what you're in essence making is a really...
a cocktail.
A really beautiful... pineapple salsa, right? Like, so you should have like this lemony, limey, fruity after hit of, it should be very, very light on the heat. And then you can make that in the morning and just sort of have it there. And then take out the swordfish steaks on a griddle pan or a barbecue. If you have the pan with the lines, rub the fish with oil, salt it really well, and then grill mark it, finish it in the oven, or just keep turning it on the, if you're happy enough.
You can eat swordfish like medium, right?
Yeah, medium.
It'll get dry if you keep cooking.
Yeah, so you just, you really, really do not want to overcook the swordfish, because it kind of, it'll just flake away, it'll just come on, almost just be tough, you know. But then just serve it with like a couple of spoonfuls of this pineapple salsa kind of coming off it. And if you can find plantains in an Asian market, peel them, slice them in a mandolin really thinly, and serve them on the side, sort of crisp. And then maybe some roasted sweet potato or sweet potato wedges. And that'll give you a really summery, lighty kind of a swordfish dish.
And on the wine, what would you?
Montrachet or Chablis for me.
Okay.
I love Montrachet. It's a really minerally sort of dry white wine. Absolutely, just sit it in your freezer for about an hour before you want to, you want the condensation coming down the side of the bottle. But you'll look at Montrachet in the glass, it's almost yellow, like good Chablis, Grand Cru, the same. Not crazy money, but a really beautiful, dry, you have enough fruit going on, a really dry, crisp, minerally white wine, and Montrachet and Chablis, or even Sancerre, or Touraine, if you don't want to spend an awful lot of money. Touraine is a Loire Valley wine, dry whites as well. Absolutely beautiful. $10 will buy you a stunning bottle of Touraine. Really nice with this.
Okay, on to the next one. Hello, Gareth and Gary. My son is finishing school this year and is absolutely determined to become a chef. He's been working as a waiter in a local hotel since he was 16 and just loves the culinary environment. Gareth, you spoke so well on a recent pod about how the image of a kitchen being a terrifying one for those working under a chef is more of a stereotype. And I wanted to ask both your opinions, as he is a sensitive lad and I'm a bit wary of how he'd react to such pressure. Many thanks, Jason in Clondalkin.
Well, first of all, is that kitchens are designed to be kind of move quickly. So when an order comes out of a machine, they're called microsses or a POS, you've got like 12, 14, 15 minutes before the guest is kind of going, like, where's my food? So like you're on a clock every time you place an order. So it kind of moves past everybody being uber polite to each other. It's not about them not being polite, but like when the chef calls out a check, he's going to say two of this, three of that, two, and then everybody goes, yes, chef. And so from the outside looking in, you might think that's a pure ego thing. It's not. Mm. So when everybody answers you, when you're the chef, you're making sure that they heard you. So, but that environment can sound like the people are being very blunt with each other. And I remember first going into the kitchen, into kitchens when I was, I went in my first job in the kitchen, I was 13, I think, or 14 maybe. This kind of loud shouting at one another, you kind of think, what's wrong with everybody? Nobody's saying please, nobody's saying thank you. It's all designed to be very direct and quick to save on time. So like when I interview somebody that's just coming out of school, I'll say, look, for the first 2 or 3 months when you come in here, that you have to learn that. Like I'll want something off Gary and I'll say, right, Gary, do this for me. And then I'll move on to the next thing. And he goes, Gareth's not being rude with me there. He's just prioritising his time because he needs to think about the next thing. So when you learn that early on, it becomes part of
the culture. And it's not personal.
It's not personal, ever. And also, you know, if you make a mistake, grand, you make a mistake. Let's park the mistake and you talk about it after service. Mm. And like, a lot of my best friends are chefs and people that work in the industry. So, you know, I have a habit of not spending time with people that I don't like. I want to spend time with people that I like, that, you know, so, but you need to learn that kind of blunt communication. And these are the reason why I went into talking about that, is that if you are somebody that's young coming into the business, I hope they sit beside somebody that's a professional that really cares about the industry, and they're going to tell them the stuff that I've just been talking about there, because it really helped me earlier on in my career when I was around seasoned professionals, that the times where I was feeling a bit, oh man, this isn't for me, they were able to pull me to one side and go, Gareth, you know, keep your eye on the prize, keep pushing on, you're in an environment that's, you know, very competitive, and good kitchens are competitive spaces. Yeah. Everybody's trying to make the grill section or make their way up. So yeah, you know, I asked Mick about it there. Like, imagine someone telling you not to be in the field. You know, like you'd said, you weren't sure whether your kids want to go in that. But if you have someone that is into it, don't stop them. Let them go and give it a lash.
Mm. But Gareth's right. First things first, if you're worried about your son, and I have two sons and a daughter, and I would be very worried about them. I'd be very particular about where they're going. First thing I'd say is start at 5-star. Start at the creme de la creme. Oh. The best hotels and the best restaurants, A, none of them want bad publicity. Two, they've all reached for excellence, and you don't get there by being an asshole. A whole team is what gets you to 5 stars in a 5-star hotel or restaurant of the year in that instance. Yes, there is going to be an element as well of, you know, there is some things that go on in these environments, just exactly what Gareth said there, where it's not going to be, hey, Johnny, how are you today? Would you mind passing me the foie gras, please, at 8 o'clock on a Saturday night? It's like, Johnny, I need the fucking foie gras. Let's go. Good man, good man. What's the crack? Whoa, Spurs lost again. You're so shite. And then you keep going. You have a bit of crack. And it's all go, 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 go. High tempo, good-natured environment. But you're getting to the point. But there's no doubt about it. It was a bigger problem many, many years ago. Yes, there are still some shit bosses. Yes, there are still some bad kitchens out there. But if you go to places where they're serious about how they do things, generally the cat's at the top. And it doesn't take long to find out. Ask a few questions. Go in somewhere for lunch. Pull the waiter aside. Say, hey, what's it like to work here? Is it nice? I was thinking about it, but just go to the bar. Have a pint or two. They'll tell you. The chef isn't dishing them out a wee sneaky steak here and there or a wee whatever. He's always an asshole. He's always whatever. They'll tell you. Yep. They'll tell you. Just go and hunt it down and do whatever. You know. And also, don't be mollycoddling the kid too much either. You know, let them figure some things out for themselves. You know what I mean? But aim high and you should be golden.
Great answer. Okay, final one for culinary conundrums for this week. Hi guys, Dishing It Out is absolutely my favourite pod, so keep up the great work. I know it's not the season, but I really want to get into barbecuing this year and would love some basic advice on how best to get started. My biggest question really is whether I should go gas or charcoal, and what are the best steak cuts to use? Barry in Claremorris.
Well, Barry and Claire Morris, you were talking to two barbecue pitmasters right here. Thank you very much. We do like to spark up the old barbecues every now and again. Look, charcoal number one anyway for me. Gas is handy and it's convenient or whatever, but I just don't like a gas flame going into food direct that I'm about to eat, you know. With the charcoal, you know, you can buy lump coal, like Irish lump stuff, if you want to, you know, buy something that's Irish and authentic. You can get it from here, there and everywhere. You can add smoke to it. You can add more. You can manipulate the flavor more by buying, you know, whiskey oak smoke chippings and soaking them in water and dispersing them in amongst the coal or oak or whatever wood you, and it just does what it says on the tin. There's lots of whiskey oak out there, like old barrels that would have aged whiskey. They get chopped down or chipped down. A lot of guys that make bacon or smoke salmon or smoke bacon or smoke sausages tend to use whiskey oak barrels. I buy them. Applewood is a really good one, beechwood. So definitely go with charcoal. I like the Kamado Joes, you know what I mean? I have a few different types of barbecues. You don't want to maybe go down the route I've gone down where you're always in trouble with your wife and you're either buying motorbikes or buying barbecues that you don't need, you can't afford, but you buy it anyway because you think you're cool. I am cool. And as far then as cuts of meat, listen, cuts of meat all depends on how much time you have at your disposal. Obviously, when it comes to lamb, shoulders and leg are amazing. You know, they're like, lamb sort of leg is a first class cut. That's a bit quicker, like you're looking at a few hours there. Shoulder, it's lower temperature, longer time. The daddy of all that everybody likes to, at some point in their barbecue career, you're going to want to do a brisket of beef. You're going to want to try and have a brisket in your barbecue for 8 to 12 hours. And when you take off the peach paper and you touch it and you rest it and then you slice it and you turn it over, It's got this beautiful pink hue on it. And that, my friend, is whenever you just clap the crowd and you walk around your house with your shirt off and you rub your belly and you wave over at your neighbour, give him the middle finger and say,
Who
the man?
Yeah.
I'm the man.
Remind me not to go for a barbecue. It's turning into a sex party.
I think really with the decision that's made is what's your budget. Yeah. You know, so barbecues, you can really spend what you want on them. Gary there said the Komodo Joe, we actually have one of them as well. So look, it's the egg, ceramic egg barbecue. You have to spend about £1,500. So, but if you own a ceramic egg barbecue, then you're into the world of slow roasting, briskets and bits and pieces like that. And, you know, that's only for the medium-sized one. If you want to buy the bigger one, again, you're up into $2,500-3,000. Yeah, I mean, they're saucy. But I actually have a small little gas barbecue as well. The challenge is with the likes of a Komodo Joe, they take about a half an hour to get cleaned, lit. So it's not the type of thing you just come in from work and say, right, I'm going to throw on a couple of steaks. So, you know, that's where I have a small little Weber. During the summer, I have the both of them out on the deck.
And as regards the cleaning, do you clean it straight after or before you start the next cook?
Well, no, the Komodo Joe in particular has vents on it. So all you just do is give the grates buy yourself a good wire brush, give them a good scrape, and then you let it burn out. I always burn my coal out, but some people close them up and try and save the coal, but I don't think it's worth saving. And that process of it just burning itself off will clean the coals for you. And then the little technique then is just if you get just a bit of kitchen towel, put a little bit of vegetable oil and just give the grates a little wipe and just keeping them kissed with a little bit of vegetable oil will stop them from rusting over on you. With the little Weber one that I have, that's a gas barbecue. Again, you have to preheat things to stop it from everything from sticking on it. So the same thing, leave the lid down, light it up full, have it up full blast, and then just give it a really good wire brush after it's hot. And then the same thing, give it a wipe. Another little trick you can do is cut a lemon in half and put a little bit of vegetable oil in the bottom of a plate, sit the lemon in it, and then use a tongs, pick the lemon up and give your bars a good wash. That also is a good little trick for cleaning them. When it comes to cuts of meat, I'll just talk about beef because you spoke about lamb. So really what you'll be thinking about is it's really about fat content, I think, more than what works better on the barbecue. You can barbecue any cut of meat. But I'm a fan of ribeye myself. My wife and son like fillet. My daughter likes ribeye or sirloin. So it's really, again, comes down to budget. Fillet is generally the most expensive. The reason I like ribeye is because of the fat. And generally when there's fat, there's a lot of flavour. So it's really about, I would just say, rather than getting caught up in the cut of it, try and buy beef that's dry-aged if you can. Spend a little bit more money on buying beef that's that you know where it's from and it's dry-aged.
Brilliant. Yeah,
and a wee quick one on the barbecue size as well, right? Even if you have the money and you want to go with a bigger one, you got to bear in mind the bigger the egg, the bigger the barbecue, the more coal you use. So if you've only a house of like you and your partner or one or two kids, so it's only maybe three or four. So every time that you use that barbecue, if you're not somebody that's hosting dinner parties all the time, really, really avoid getting the big Komodo Joe, say, or the largest green egg. Like, go in between, simply because you're nearly going to use almost a full 10-kilo bag on even cooking four steaks, because the surface area is really, really big, and it is something that people don't bear in mind. And the last thing that you ever want to do is to not barbecue then, just because you're like, oh, geez, it's going to take a half an hour to get it up to temperature. So sometimes going small is actually the smartest strategy. And keep an eye on Lidl, or maybe even Aldi, but definitely Lidl, nearly every year coming into the season, for 99 quid, for as many years as I remember, they've put like a wee unbranded ceramic egg on the market where they do these wee deals. They're 99 quid. I got one year, and it is identical to the green eggs and Komodo Joes.
Really? Yeah.
They are the most unbelievable piece of kit that you'll buy, and for 99 quid,
that one's only suitable for cooking steaks. It's quite small.
Yeah, it's
so
really
you won't be
small.
Be able to do a brisket, or you'd probably get a chicken into it. But
yeah, you get a whole chicken into it, but just to bear in mind, like that, if you wanted to sort of test the waters, and you ever see it, keep an eye on their social channels, because everything sells out really, really quickly. But that is something that's well worth queuing for. If you've never joined that rush to get something kind of cool and funky, it's worth $299 or more, never mind the $99, but it's really, really a lovely bit of kit if you ever get your hands on one.
Great stuff, great questions, great answers, and Barry will be down to Clare Morris in and around June
to
check out the wares.
Watch rubbing your belly.
We'll put two shirts on, Gary.
Went too far.
Thank you all so much for your questions. Don't forget, it's food at goloudnow.com. Keep them coming.
Okay, that completes another episode of Dishing It Out, and what a fantastic guest Mick was. I knew he was going to be intriguing, and I hope it wasn't too much of a techie show for a lot of people, but I do think it gives you an insight into the world of what it takes to not only get two Michelin stars, but retain them, and possibly by the time this comes out, he will have had gotten his third Michelin star.
Possibly a third.
But I knew, I know Mick a long time, and he's somebody that really intrigues me because he's really, really at the very, very top of his career. Mm. And he stayed up there. He's somebody that brings a lot of innovation into the world of Irish food. He brings an awful lot of technique. He's probably the most technical chef that we have cooking in the country. Yeah. But I just thought it was really lovely to hear him talk about what is the most important thing when it comes to food, and not just in the world of professional flavour.
It's
where it starts and stops. And I think as a young chef, if you learn that early doors, then you're on the right path.
Well, flavour is what gets you back on the seat. I think no matter what, I mean, you never remember the stuff that looks fancy pantsy and sitting.
Thought it was also nice to hear him talk about, you know, like how the restaurants are a fun place and they're somewhere that you should be going to celebrate, and how the people treat you and look after you. And I think that can also, I mean, we gave a couple examples of it, but you know, restaurants should be somewhere where you're enjoying yourself. And if you're not, then you're not in the right place.
No.
So and even when you hear, I think from the outside, when you hear the word Michelin star, you automatically think, you don't think of them as being these fun places, but you just heard it from one of the best in the country there. What he's trying to do is create memorable experiences to bring you back.
Yeah.
So, brilliant show. Look forward to it.
No, that was good to have him in,
And thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week, as always, with Dishing It Out with me, Gareth Mullins.
And me, Gary O'Hanlon.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.